Thanks you all. Thanks everyone to coming out and tell you what we mostly don't know about the microbiome. What we do know is that everyone in this room has one, and so we'll go from there. You may remember 15 years ago, perhaps, Rose Garden of the White House, President Clinton, Francis Collins, Craig Venter announcing the publishing of the Human Genome Project, that this was hot stuff. And has continued to be hot stuff. And we realized at that time that, you know, technicalities, that it really wasn't the human genome. We didn't really sequence everything that was there. But us microbiologists, we were pretty indignant, actually, because we knew that less than 1% of the genes that we all possess are actually human, that the rest of the genes that we all have are bacterial. And we knew squat, basically, about what they did. And that if you counted up the number of cells, I mean, this varies depending on how full of shit you are. It varies between 10 to 1 and perhaps 1 to 10, bacterial to human. I try to stay on the 1 to 10 ratio of human to bacterial, but we'll see. And these are organisms that we find everywhere, right? And so people love to go around pumping Purell to, you know, you can buy it in gallons from Amazon. Pretty sweet. At the same time, you can go out and buy Danone yogurt to populate your gut, right? So we have this kind of schizophrenic attitude towards the bacteria in the world around us, and that's fine. But you might want to think about that. And so with this in mind, the Human Microbiome Project was launched by same Francis Collins, former U of M professor. I walk by his picture pretty much every day when I walk into MedSci 1. We don't hold that against him too much, even though he doesn't send us too much money. But we went about sequencing the bacteria that live on and in a large number of people. And so this was really exciting. And the punchline was, we don't know anything. That everybody in this room is totally different. If you're siblings, you're probably more similar to each other. If you're cohabiting, you're probably more similar to each other than anybody else. But in general, everybody in this room is different. And that if we lined everybody up, if I got a crap sample from everyone and sequenced it and looked at the type of bacteria in there, there would not be a species of bacteria that was shared across everybody in the room. And that's awesome. It's really frustrating, though, also scientifically. But it also gets to the idea of what is normal, right? And so we're all, I think, healthy. I don't see anyone kind of oozing out any orifices. We're all healthy, perhaps. And we're all very different. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind, is that we can be quite different and at the same time be very healthy. And so who cares about the microbiome? Well, you should. There's evidently some guy on YouTube that put up a video about how he made himself germ-free. That's not true. if you made yourself germ-free, you'd be in a load of hurt. The mice that we raise over on campus that we raise germ-free, they're not doing so well, right? Their immune systems are screwed up. There's a paper that came out this past week that your blood-brain barrier is screwed up. You don't want to be germ-free, okay? So lay easy on the Purell. I know some of you are drinking bleach to get rid of your microbes, so stop it. But it helps to develop your immune system, helps in something we call colonization resistance, so that, you know, pathogens aren't constantly coming into you. We think it's important things like obesity, diabetes. My lab's interested in things like colon cancer, and Crohn's disease, infections like Clostridium difficile. These are all, we think, related to the microbiome. And so I have a quote here from what I consider to be the grandfather of the human microbiome. And he said, it would appear to be a pointless and doubtful exercise to examine and disentangle the apparently random appearing bacteria in normal feces and the intestinal tract, a situation that seems controlled by 1,000 coincidences. I was thinking from the previous talk that I wasn't going to mention complexity, but I think I just did. That this is a pediatrician who had moms bringing babies to him, who just had horrible diarrhea, and they didn't know what was going on. Yet, and I think, you know, most grad students and postdocs here will relate to this, you know, struggling for a whole year. virtually exclusively to this special study. It was with the conviction that the accurate knowledge of these conditions is essential for the understanding of not only the physiology of digestion, but also the pathology and therapy of microbial intestinal diseases. And so this might be a name that rings a bell to some of you, Theodore Escherich, Dr. Escherich, from 1885, 140 years ago. He is the E in E. coli, Escherichia coli, right? And so what he didn't realize 130 years ago was that everybody in this room has Escherichia coli in their gut. And if you don't have E. coli in your gut, you're screwed. You can't produce certain vitamins that help you clot blood. You're just in a world of hurt, right? And so if you think about what he knew in 1885 compared to what we know now, you know, Darwin had just gotten off his joyride around the earth. Haeckel had just started thinking about formalizing ecology. We didn't know what DNA was. We didn't really know what genetics was. And we're actually still doing this project. We're still trying to figure out, why do kids get diarrhea? Why are premature kids really susceptible to necrotizing enterocolitis, where their bowels just explode with bacteria? Why do people get colon cancer because of their bacteria? These are things we don't really know, and I'm not sure that Dr. Escherich, if he came back, would be very happy with how far we have taken the microbiome. And so it really calls out for an interdisciplinary approach to what we're doing. And as Mariah mentioned, I live on a farm out in Dexter, and this is a picture that is my motivation, that makes me think about the microbiome. And here you have my young bride, Sarah, in pink, my daughter, Ruth, and our ewe, who just happens to be named Ruth as well. And she's nursing her two lambs, who had just been born, okay, in a pasture in our backyard. And so thinking about this, Ruth was nursed for 2 years. These lambs are being nursed right now. You know, Ruth is eating a popsicle, I believe, in pasture that's probably littered with manure. And thinking about, what does this do to Ruth's microbiome versus if she lived, say, in, I don't know, Ann Arbor or Ipsy or in a city, right, or in an apartment building? How is Ruth's microbiome going to be different now that she lives out in Dexter in a farm versus if she lived here in Ann Arbor? And how are Ruth, the ewe's lambs, going to be different living with her on pasture versus on a feedlot getting corn, okay? Not that there's anything wrong with that. And what do we get as carnivores who are going to eat Ruth's lambs at some point, who have been eating grass or the cows on our farm or the pigs that live in a more natural setting than perhaps in an industrial operation? These are things we don't know, but are definitely interesting questions and things to think about. And so this cycle of Sarah to Ruth, Ruth to her lambs, and the nature and the environment around them are really important and interesting to me. All right, and so here's another picture. Sorry, I show lots of pictures of my family. I do have 7 children. In this picture, there's only 6. What you're witnessing here is a miracle, and not that there's some crazy woman out there willing to have my children, but there's little Jacob here, who is just born. He was the first of these 6 kids that was born via C-section up at Mott Hospital. And so, again, you could say, is Jacob screwed because he was born by C-section? We don't know, right? We know that kids born by C-section are perhaps more susceptible to things like asthma. But we could say, well, probably his microbiota looks just fine. We don't really know. Is Ruth, whose lap he's sitting on there, colonizing him, right? And also, he was born sterile, right? So he's 2 hours old here, and his gut is just getting pounded by the bacteria around him. And that's awesome. And so you could say, well, what effect does this have on Jacob now that he's, I think he's 4, 10 years from now, or 20 years from now, or 30 years from now? And these are things we just don't know, but we're really excited and trying to find out. And so as a good dad, I sent out an email to my department, and Fred Neidhart is probably the person in the world that knows more about E. coli than anybody else. And he said, though the addition of one more individual host may seem trivial, microbiologists are a really exciting bunch. And though I'm not certain that E. coli needs this incremental addition to its habitat, I rejoice with you and Sarah and Jacob that you have all found each other and will be sharing bacteria and viruses for years to come. I mean, if you don't know any microbiologists, you need to get to know some of us. There's a few here I can introduce you. We could do speed dating. And so there's all sorts of, like, I mean, that's a great hypothesis. I am going to, this weekend, I think, start writing my next NIHR01 to test this hypothesis that we're actually sharing microbes. I was actually writing a white paper about this today, that's a hypothesis that we can go out and test. And actually, you can test this too now, which is kind of exciting. And by that, I mean, you can do an experiment on yourself. And I'm not saying this is a good or bad thing, but it's a thing, right? So you can collect a stool sample of yourself. You can ship it off to, I think, Boulder, Colorado, to the American Gut Project, and they will sequence your microbiome. Okay? They will tell you what's in your feces, what's in your gut. And people are doing this. They're, say, changing their diet. They're collecting a sample, changing their diet, and taking another sample. Or they're, say, taking a stool sample, coming out to live, listen to Pat give a talk, drink beer, do a few shots, take another sample and send it off, right? How does your gut community change drinking alcohol? I don't think there's a paper out there doing that. There's another group called U-Biome. You can also send a stool sample off. This is about $100 to send off a sample. So the thing is, you get data back, and I'm a person that spends my life studying this. And the data you get back, I would look at it and be like, I don't know what it means, right? What's interesting is that you are your own control in these studies. And that's, I think, really important to know, is that because everybody here is different, that you really do need to compare yourself to yourself. And so you can go out, and find blogs where people are doing this. And again, it's citizen science, and it's great to see people excited about this, but again, it's difficult to know how to interpret this. So here's a woman, Phoenix Helix, she's talking about having some autoimmune problems, and so she's collecting stool samples and then doing some diet change and then collecting some more stool samples. And she gets a stacked bar chart back like this, and you can see varying shades of red and yellow and whatnot corresponding to different groups of bacteria, things like Firmicutes and Bacteroidetes, and if you ever took Latin, you're probably having bad flashbacks at this moment. And the comparisons are you on the far left, and then you compared to the average person. You compared to someone with a similar diet, same gender, similar BMI, similar age, and Michael Pollan. Why would you want a microbiome that looks anything like Michael Pollan? I can't see what slides are coming up next to lead you in. And so why would you want a microbiome like Michael Pollan? I have no idea. But you can see she's not very much like Michael Pollan. But another experiment people are doing on the microbiome is they're doing at-home fecal transplants, okay? And I'm sorry that the kitchen is about to close probably because I just said that out loud. But for people with chronic recurrent Clostridium difficile infection, this is the only way, for the most part, to cure them. We have no idea how it works. Doesn't seem to work for anything else. So the idea that you could safely do a home fecal transplant is a misnomer, okay? Because there's viruses, and how do you know what somebody else has? You could be getting a microbiome from somebody associated with colon cancer and not know that, right? But, I mean, through the power of Google, there's 500,000 pages out there on how to do a fecal transplant at home. There is a anthropologist, quote unquote, named Jeff Leach, who is currently in Africa, and he did a fecal transplant with someone from the Hadza, which is a kind of isolated nomadic community that he thinks has a better microbiome than us, right? And I suspect the Hadza wish they might have a lifestyle that's perhaps a little bit more like us because of things like disease, right? And so you can read in all graphic gory detail how he used a turkey baster to give himself a fecal transplant. Not advisable, but again, the joy of citizen science. And so getting back to this idea of Michael Pollan and the microbiome, you could begin to think about, you know, he's a nice looking guy. He's got good teeth. His family just published a cookbook. I like his books. He would probably love to visit my farm and see how we're raising our animals. But perhaps, you know, I'm still not sure why I want his microbiome. And so the thing to keep in mind is that there's really no reason for me to want Michael Pollan's microbiome. As I mentioned, everybody in this room has a different gut community, and we're all different. There is no single healthy microbiome. And what we found in my lab, using data from the Human Microbiome Project, is that you can take large numbers of people, could take everybody in this room, and more or less we can bin you into different types of communities where, as you can see in these box and whisker plots, varying abundances of these different organisms like Bacteroides, Prevotella, Aelastipius, Faecalibacterium, and other bad Latin names. What this means, we still don't know, right? That, you know, are one of these types of communities more associated with disease? We don't know. But we know there's this variation in diversity, and we're trying to figure out what it means. And so, I'm not swayed. I want Mike's microbiome. So if I wanted to take on Michael Pollan's microbiome, what might I do? I could start eating like Mike, right? What else could I do?
Move.
I could move where? I could hang out with Mike, right? I could be his BFF, yeah.
You could make out with him.
I could do a fecal transplant. I could make out with him. Yes, that's, thank you. Yes. Tongue microbiome. What else could I do? This is... Any ideas?
We could bathe together.
We could bathe together, yeah. Okay. Maybe audience participation was not advised. So diet, right? So I could start eating like Mike. And so Pete Turnbaugh at Harvard did a study where they took people and they basically gave them what I call the state fair diet, right? Where they ate everything fried, they ate donuts, they ate just red meat galore. I eat a lot of meat, but I mean, these people, when I read what they ate, my heart about exploded. And so what you can see on the right here is the animal-based diet, on the left, the plant-based diet, and on the top, kind of fiber intake. And you can see in the green is when they did this diet perturbation. They even got a vegetarian to start eating meat for this experiment. Amazing. And so what you see on the bottom then is how their gut microbiota changed. And what you see in the bottom right are people that went on a meat diet, their community changed a bunch, and then it came back to normal. Okay? And so what that says is that diet alone is not enough to permanently alter your microbiome. So if I go hang out with Mike wherever he lives and then come back, my community is going to come back to where it is currently. Other people at University of Pennsylvania and Gary Wu's lab have done this where they took a decent number of people, put them into an institutional setting and gave them a controlled diet, and their community changes on the first day, but as you can kind of see in this hideous plot on the left, that you tend to stay more similar to who you are, right? So if you put me on a vegan diet, I am not going to start looking like a vegan. I'm going to look like Pat Schloss on a vegan diet, okay? And so I will still retain the signature of who I am. Antibiotics, right? You'd think, well, that's like the nuclear bomb of the microbiome. And actually what we see is that you put somebody on antibiotics, yeah, your community changes while you're on antibiotics, but you come back looking more like you than you would look like anybody else. And even when you're on antibiotics, you still look more like you than anyone else. Okay? So we're not doing too well at altering the microbiome. Fecal transplant. So this is data from Vince Young, who's over here on the left, and Anna Seacats, who's probably hiding in back here, where they worked with people where these are people that had chronic C. difficile infections, tons of antibiotic exposures to get rid of C. difficile, and again, the miracle drug, or not really a drug, is fecal transplants. And so in this study, what they looked at were people in the red across the top before the fecal transplant, the blue is the donor, and the green is after fecal transplant. And then the heat map relates, you know, abundance of these different types of bugs in these different individuals. And so what you can see in the red arrows are patient 11. And what you see is what you'd expect. Patient 11 got a fecal transplant from somebody and starts to look like their donor. And then you have other people, like individual green, in green here, where it doesn't totally come back to what their donor looked like. And then the person in blue here also doesn't totally look like their donor. So even if I give you large doses of antibiotics and then give you somebody else's microbiome, you're not going to look like them, okay? So keep the turkey baster away. So my hypothesis, and I have no data, is that the toilet is the vector of the microbiome. That we know that people that live in a house have a more similar microbiota, even if you're not related. And so every time you hit that plunger, you have trillions of bacteria aerosolizing into the air, and you then suck them in, right? Parting thought. So somebody said I could make out with them. I could make out with them. And this is great because this came out, a paper this past week. The Dutch, I mean, these people are crazy. They went to the zoo. They recruited 100 people to suck face for 10 seconds and to swap spit. And what they saw, the more you play tonsil hockey, the more similar your microbiome looks. And so I called my wife and I said, when was the last time we had an intimate kiss? She said, I want to say it was yesterday. I was like, it was like longer than that ago. And so some of these people are having 120 intimate kisses a week. And I'm thinking, how do I have 7 kids? But what you see is that the more kisses you have per week, the more similar your community is. And the longer the time between kisses, the less similar your community, your oral community is, right? And so we think that the oral community is related to the gut community. So perhaps if I start kissing Mike, 10 times a day for 10 seconds a pop, we might have some convergence, okay? But you need 9 servings a day to have a similar oral microbiota. Not sure what this means. My wife has horrible teeth, so I don't know that I really want her microbiome. I've never had a cavity in my life. So, Michael Pollan, and I, like I said, I don't want to suck face. I'm sure he's a nice guy. So how do you foster a healthy microbiota? There's a science writer named Ed Yong in England is working on a great microbiome book, I'm sure, and he published an editorial in the New York Times a few weeks ago saying there is no healthy microbiota. Again, everybody in this room, I think, is pretty healthy, and we all have very different microbiota. So what should you do, right? And I'm not a physician. I can point you to physicians, but I think just common sense, right? So probiotics. People say, well, let's take probiotics. We could take other bacteria and bring them in. There's a lot of what we might call anecdata where, oh, yeah, I swear by whatever. But I'm pretty sure Jamie Lee Curtis and Activia, sorry, were sued actually for making health claims that they could not substantiate. So there's limited to no evidence that probiotics help. But if you think about it, what do you eat? When you eat a pizza, you think, I'm eating cheese, that's fermented. No, mozzarella is really not fermented anymore. American cheese is not fermented. We could think about prebiotics, and we could eat foods that feed our bacteria. And one of the things that Michael Pollan actually says that I agree with is eat like your mom, or eat like your grandmother, right? And so eat diets high in fiber, low in simple sugars, low processed foods. These are kind of common sense things, but nobody wants to do because it tastes bad. I like my Big Mac with special sauce, right? Maybe I don't. I'm sick of them, but I don't want to eat, green leafy vegetables all the time. And you want to limit your antibiotic exposures. And so Marty Blaser is a physician at NYU who's really concerned about antibiotics and the effect it's having on our kids. There's lots of reasons to be worried about our kids. I'm not sure that antibiotics is number one, but we certainly think that antibiotics are having perhaps long-term effects on your gut microbiota. And so a path forward, and this is a bit of a premature sales pitch, but what we need to understand, a lot of where I say we don't know or we don't have a clue, is a large cohort of individuals that we can sample periodically over long periods of time and see changes in their community, changes in their gut, corresponding to changes in health. So you could say, oh yeah, my community really changed because, I went on a bender that night at Nerd Night because Pat's talk was so bad, and that's really changed my gut community, right? We don't know, but we need to sample large numbers of people over time to start to understand these relationships better. And so with that, keep in mind that there's lots of awesome microbiome stuff going on at the U of M, and if you ever have questions, feel free to shoot us an email. I am on Twitter, Pat Schloss, but be happy to take any questions you all might have and tell you that I don't know.